Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, you know, Paul Green's name is all over our community, all over Chapel Hill. The Paul Green Theater jumps into my mind, where the Playmakers have their professional productions. The Glenwood neighborhood, it's just the beginning of the marks that Paul Green left in Chapel Hill. And so I'm curious, Marcia Warren, a literary queen who has made North Carolina literature one of her principal preoccupations, is also the executive director of the Paul Green Foundation, and she has been given wonderful programs about Paul Green. But Marcia, for those people who have heard the name of Paul Green but don't know who he is, who was Paul Green?
Well, it's fun to talk about Paul Green. He came up here the first time that I'm remembering of the history in 1916. He had been trying for years to get up here to Chapel Hill. It wasn't called the University of North Carolina. It wasn't called Carolina. It was called Chapel Hill. So if you went to Chapel Hill, it meant you were coming to the university. And he wanted very much to come up here, but he didn't have the money. He was coming from Lillington, down in Harnett County. So he was here from 1916 and then throughout his entire life until he died here at DG in 1981 at the age of 87.
What do we I mentioned a couple of things that people might hear the name Green, but he has many other important legacies. If you were writing a brief Wikipedia article about him, one paragraph, what would be the things on his list of accomplishments?
Well, the thing that people are going to come immediately to is the Lost Colony, like you say. But right along with his
What did he have to do with the Lost Colony?
In the 1930s, the folks in Dare County commissioned Paul Green to write a story about the 350th anniversary of the British who first came to our shores in 1587. And so they were going to celebrate, and he went down there and looked around, and of course he knew the history of the Lost Colony and the mysterious disappearance of the lost colonists. So he wrote this play called The Lost Colony. And what he brought to that was a new art form, and he called it symphonic drama. And he had come about that by having been in Europe on several Guggenheim fellowships. And in other times when he was over in Europe, he knew the Greek theater. He knew the outdoors theater. He knew about the wonderful sound and light shows that they had in Paris. And he came back and he brought it all together. He knew music very well, so he put music and dance and story and light all together, and he was excited about this art form. And he went on to write 16 more. So altogether, D.G., he wrote 17 outdoor dramas.
Well, is it fair to say he founded the outdoor drama medium?
Yeah,
America?
Yeah, he's called the creator or the father of outdoor drama. And right now, of course, across the country, there are outdoor dramas all across the country. And some of them are religious. Some of them are historical. There's Shakespeare outdoor plays. But these are historical plays. And they're made, the thing that's very unique about it is that they are made and performed in the very place where that happened, where that incident happened. So, for example, with the Lost Colonists, it was right there on Roanoke Island where they landed in 1587. And his big Texas musical is right out there in Texas in a canyon right outside of Amarillo. And up in Ohio, we have one called Trumpet in the Land. And that is right there where the man who came through had his story told. And so what's so nice about it is that the people from that area can come and sit outdoors under the stars in their regular clothes and see a story that happened right there in their own community.
Marcia, help me with this. The Lost Colony is intricately woven into the history and the fabric of the North Carolina culture. Before Paul Green wrote the drama or produced the drama and it caught on and is still going, was the Lost Colony always such an important part of our history, or has the Lost Colony production sort of sealed that deal?
Well, that's a wonderful question, and I don't know when they started being called the Lost Colonists. What happened, DG, was when the colonists came over with their families and Eleanor Dare had the first little English baby born in the New World, and her father was John White, who was drawing the pictures of the Indians, the Native Americans that he saw and everything he saw. And they were running out of supplies. It was getting very desperate. And he said, I will return to England and I will be back in 3 months. It'll take me a month to go over there, a month to load up, and a month to come back. But what happened was when he arrived in England, Queen Elizabeth was being greatly stressed by the wars that were being perpetrated against them, especially the Spanish Armada. And the Spanish Armada was about to come down on England, and she said that no ships of any size could leave. And so John White did not get back until 3 years later. And when he came back, everything was gone. The people were gone, and the only thing that they found was a word, Croatan, which was spelling an Indian name and a place, and it was in a tree, carved in the side of the tree. Now they were going to follow that and go down to that place where they knew it was to see if they had gone in to live with the Indians. But a storm came up, and the pilot of the boat said, we cannot look any further. We have to return to England now. So it's a great tragedy that if they'd only been able to go a little bit inland, they might actually have been able to discover. And then since that time, the stories abound of Indians Native Americans who have blue eyes. And there were sightings of them tilling the soil as the British would have, and the clothing. And so there's lots of stories like that. Indeed, if you go down to Robeson County, you're going to see some very beautiful people that have a kind of combination of. So that's who the Lost Colonists are. These are the Lumbee Indians on the Lumber River there.
Well, that's really interesting. The other point that some people have suggested to me is that Paul Green had an agenda as he wrote this. And I'm not saying that in any negative way at all, but that we were in the middle of getting over the Depression, in the middle of really the Roosevelt democratization of the United States in competition with maybe some elitist notions of how our country should be, and that Paul Green was a person of the people and wanted to suggest that these people from England came over and they were more democratic than they would have been had they been in England. That they had to did he write some democracy into the play that might have come more from Paul Green than from actual history, you think?
Well, he absolutely did, and it's a wonderful part. And one of the roles in the play is Old Tom, and he has been a no-count person in England. He didn't have any money, didn't have any family to speak of. He didn't have an education or a job, per se, and he did a lot of drinking. But he was one of the ones that came over on that boat that brought the colonists. And there he was, and the denouement of the story is when he is standing up on the above the, it's at night, and he is in charge, and he says this wonderful thing. So think about it, me, of all people, where in England I was nothing, and here I am with the care of 60 people in my grip, and I am up here, and he was walking along the turret to look out for any trouble while the people slept. So he had a good part of the story there that was a wonderful thing. And, you know, you mentioned elitism, because that really sparked something else I wanted to say. Because Paul Green had already had a work on Broadway. He'd already won the Pulitzer Prize in 1927 for his play In Abraham's Bosom. And he became very discouraged with Broadway because it was elite. because they were choosing things that maybe he thought were not always the best, because not everybody could go, because you had to have the right clothes to go to those, and you had to get there. So he really turned the corner in 1937, and from 1937 pretty much on, he stuck with his outdoor drama. And he had learned that back at Chapel Hill under Prof. Koch, who had talked to his playwriting students about folk plays, write plays about the people. And so that really became Paul's life, yeah.
If you join us late, I'm visiting with Marcia Warren. She is the executive director of the Paul Green Foundation. We're talking about Paul Green. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Marcia Warren. She is the great Chapel Hill neighbor and also the executive director of the Paul Green Foundation. And she's telling us a little bit about this iconic Chapel Hill figure who was known nationwide, worldwide, for his contributions. Marcia talked a little bit about the Lost Colony, which was clearly, created by Paul Green. And when we broke, you talked a little bit about his association with Prof. Koch. Who was Prof. Koch, and how were they rivals or colleagues, partners, in things? What was that relationship?
Well, that was a wonderful thing to happen, because Paul Green had left campus. He'd come in 1916 to Chapel Hill, but the next year he really felt like he had to, even though he was anti-war, completely anti-war, he felt like he had to follow the call of President Woodrow Wilson, that it would be the war to end wars. And he really wanted to believe that. And so he signed up. He enlisted in the North Carolina 105th Engineers right there in Chapel Hill, and he went off to the trenches of France and Belgium for 2 years in very heavy, very dangerous work. And when he returned in 1919, he came back to campus to go to school, and he went into a playwriting class. And in the meanwhile, while Paul was in the trenches of France, Frederick Koch came from North Dakota to Chapel Hill to teach in the English department, in the drama department. And when Paul returned, he came to a playwriting class. And in that class were Thomas Wolfe and Elizabeth Ley. And Elizabeth Ley would later become his wife. And that's where Paul Green began his writing. He had written poetry throughout the war. And we have a book of all of his poems that really got him through the war. But indeed, it turned out that he was really a playwright. And Prof. Koch encouraged him to enter the playwriting competition. Well, he'd never seen a play, but he wrote a play and won the competition. It was called Surrender to the Enemy, and it was about the time when the president's daughter got married to a northern soldier, and it was really quite a thing. However, Paul Green, I think, destroyed that script, and we don't have a copy of it.
Oh,
no,
is that right?
Yeah.
Those of us who drive around in Chapel Hill, we pass the Forest Theater all the time, and that was a venue for outdoor drama.
Mm-hmm.
And who was Professor Koch responsible for that, or was Paul Green responsible for that, or how did that go?
Well, it started out, and I hate to say grassy knoll, because whenever we talk about a grassy knoll, we think about Dallas, but it was a kind of a grassy place. It didn't look like it does today. It hadn't been all fitted out with rocks and proper seating, but it was just, and that's where Paul's play was presented, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really? His first?
Yeah, Surrender to the Enemy.
We no longer have the script for.
Yeah, and apparently he was so excited and so embarrassed that he just tore out of the theater and ran away. But Prof. Koch, you're absolutely right, D.G. He's the one that then continued to support that. And I think possibly the WPA or the CCC, others came in. And through the years, it improved to the point where it is today. And
well, before we leave the outdoor drama altogether, The Lost Colony wasn't Paul Green's only outdoor drama play, was it? I mean, he hadn't written all of those that are, but he did.
So he wrote 16 more after 1937 was the first one, and he did 16 more. He did a wonderful one up in Ohio called Trumpet to the Land, the one out in Texas called the Texas Musical. He wrote the Stephen Foster story in Bardstown, Kentucky, and he wrote Common Glory and Wilderness Road up in Berea, Kentucky, and all over the place. There was one called The Lone Star down in Galveston. So we only have about three or four still going, but we're very, very happy about his work with outdoor drama.
Well, it's a really an incredible thing that the Lost Colony has been going now for,
I think it's about 80 years
80
now.
80 years,
yeah.
Without interruption. If you had a Broadway production that went on for 80 years, you would
yeah.
think that was a miracle.
And there was one interruption, DG, and that was about 42, 43, 44 during the war. We had to have blackouts on the coast. And, you know, you may know that there were German subs along our coast. So it had to be – it was not shown during that time. That's the only part.
Talk about Paul Green's Broadway career.
Mm.
You mentioned that he won a Pulitzer Prize for a play. Did it make it to Broadway?
It did, and that play was called In Abraham's Bosom, and he wrote it in 1926, and he won the Pulitzer in 1927, and the person who was up against him with that was Eugene O'Neill. I think Eugene O'Neill may have won it the next year. But the story behind In Abraham's Bosom, which is the story of a young black man who wants very much to bring education to his people. When Paul was about 10 years old and he was down in Lillington, he went with his father to the train station. His father was going to pick up some fertilizer or something. And the train was going to Durham. And it stopped there, and Paul saw that a very handsomely dressed African-American gentleman came off of the train, and behind him were all of his little students, and they were all going to go to Durham to do something. But while he was there, the train was having some trouble with the underneath the train, and the engineer was down under the train on his hands and knees with oil all over his face and his hands, and he was trying to fix whatever was wrong. And this gentleman, this black man, gentleman, a teacher with his glasses on, came over in his pretty white shirt, and he said, "Excuse me, Captain, when do you think we'll get to Durham?" Well, this totally infuriated the engineer, and he rose up out from underneath that engine, and he grabbed a cudgel, kind of a cane, that a Confederate soldier was holding in his hand to hold him up, and he struck this teacher across the face and, of course, broke his glasses and just opened up his face. And his shirt was all totally full of blood, and the children were just aghast, and they had to get back on the train. They were on, DG, they were on the train for African Americans. They were in just that car. And he got back on the train, and all the gentleman said, the teacher said to the engineer, was, "Captain, you done ruined my shirt." And those were the very words that Paul Green writes about. And he said to himself right then, "I'm going to write about a person who wants to bring education, a black man who wants to bring education to his children." And, of course, it's very different from the original incident, but that was the genesis.
That was the thing that started it.
Well, yeah.
It brings out... You know, Paul Green grew up in Harnett County, is that
mm-hmm,
right? And
Harnett.
That's known when we talk about some of the modern civil rights travelers. They were afraid to go through Harnett County because there are a number, like the engineer, I guess, of people who
yes.
have strong feelings about race. And Paul Green seems to be very much pro, I don't know whether pro-integration, but pro-good relations between mm-hmm. whites and blacks in a way that might have set him out a little bit too far ahead of other people in his home county and maybe throughout North Carolina.
And there are several things about that, and you're absolutely right. You just sort of wonder when you're reading and working with his materials, how in the world, you know, did this all come about? How was it that he had this wonderful attitude about people? Well, the answer is this, several answers. One, he was a writer in his heart, and he was doing farm work on his father's farm. And there were tenant farmers there and workers there, and he worked with them. He knew them. He heard their stories. I think of Paul Green when you read his one-act plays and his stories that will just break your heart. They're the stories of the things that had happened to those people and to those people's ancestors, which, because we're just, you know, post-Civil War, and some dreadful things. I think of him as a kind of chronicler, a kind of reporter who's there taking down in later years when he was able to know how to write. He was writing those stories down and preserving them for history, for that bit of history. The other part of it, which is very strongly in my mind, is when he was 3 years old, the tenant farmer, Will McLeod, had a little boy named Rassy. And Rassy was 3 years old, and so was Paul. And they became bosom buddies, and they did everything together, and they were wonderful. And they roamed around the farms, and they helped pick cotton, and they did all sorts of things. And Rassy was so important to Paul Green that I think that Rassy really informed Paul Green's life in the way he feels about people, in the way he always helped people. He was always helping. He and Jonathan Daniels were always over in Raleigh, pounding their fists on a table, trying to get representation for a person who was poor and didn't have proper representation. So he has always had that. The two things are hardly separated, the writing and the human rights, the writing and the social interest are evident in almost all of his work.
Mm-hmm. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Marcia Warren. She is the executive director of the Paul Green Foundation, and she's telling me a little bit about Paul Green, one of Chapel Hill's great heroes. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Marcia Warren. Marcia is the executive director of the Paul Green Foundation. We're talking about Paul Green. Mm. And before we left, we're talking a little bit about race and about his friendship with a little 3-year-old boy, a mm-hmm. friendship that apparently defined his life. Tell us more about Paul Green and the challenges of race in the prior century.
Well, he wrote this little book called Rassy after his friendship with this little child that he met when he was 3 years old. And he starts out his book saying, I have met many smart men in my life, among them lawyers and ministers and doctors, but I've never met anybody in my whole life that was as smart as Rassy or who taught me the most about life. And so that relationship, which was maybe unusual for a little black boy and a little white boy to be so closely aligned, and they had such a lot of fun together. And there are some very humorous stories about the things that Rassy teaches him. And of course, they were blood brothers. They had a little Barlow knife, which I still have at the foundation, and they cut their fingers, of course, so they could be blood brothers. Well, then, you know, as I said, I started the story about Rassy, but the ending is very, very sad, because even though he thought that he would stay with him for the rest of his life and they would be together, as a matter of fact, there was a terrible typhoid
epidemic.
Yeah, thank you, DG. The epidemic in the countryside, and all of Will McLeod's little children were getting sick, and Paul kept begging if he could go down to the tenant. He wanted to see Rassy and his sister Mary. Their mother had died, and his sister Mary had said, no, you can't go down there, and I'm going to go down and help with the children. But one day she came back and she said, now, Paul, you can come with me. And she took a little white nightshirt that belonged to Paul, and they went down there to the house. And when they walked in, there was Rassy lying on the floor, and other children were very sick. And he went over to him thinking that he was just resting, but when he touched him, he realized that he had died and he was cold. And they washed his little body, and the little cute thing he says in the story, he says, I was very careful not to wash his toe that he had stubbed because I didn't want to hurt him. So their papa made a wooden box, and they put Rassy in the box, and they took it up on the hill near a cedar tree, and they buried it in the ground. And Papa was about to go away, Paul said to his papa, aren't you going to say something over his grave? And so his father said some nonsensical thing like, you know, it just was not, and so forth and so on. And it had nothing, and Paul said it had nothing to do with Rassi. It didn't. He didn't mention that Rassi had gone to heaven, but I don't think he would have, because his papa would not have said that, because there were a lot of people in Harnett County who didn't believe that Negroes were full people and they were not going to be in heaven. But I knew, said Paul, I knew that he was there at the throne of God and being petted by all the angels. And then he took the little Barlow knife out. Oh, I forgot to tell you that Mary had said to him when they were still attending to Rassi's little body, she said, Rassi rose up on his pallet earlier today and said that you must have his Barlow knife. And she went over to the mantle and brought the Barlow knife to Paul. And so when they were getting set to go, Paul pulled a little piece of wood from somewhere and stuck it down in the grave and made a little cross on it and said, I'll be back tomorrow, and I'll say, Rassi lies here.
Oh, well. And so did you tell me that you or the foundation still has possession of that historic knife?
We have the historic, darling little Barlow knife, yeah.
Well, but go forward in Paul Green's history, and as he became an adult and then became famous, a famous writer, did his progressive views about race, did that become a positive factor in his life?
Well, I want to tell you two more stories, and one of them was an incident that happened in Charlotte. And in those days, there were chain gangs, and they were the prisoners were treated dreadfully. And Paul was so upset about it, and he heard about a case down in Charlotte where several of the members had been tied up in an unheated cell, and their feet had frozen, and they had to have their feet and legs removed. And when Paul, and it was in all the newspapers, I think their names were Barnes and Shropshire, and Paul was outraged by this. And he tried to get in touch with the legislators, like he always was over in Raleigh, trying to get them to do the right thing. But they weren't doing anything about it. And so he wrote a story called Hymn to the Rising Sun, and it's about chain gang. And he had that book, that little published book, and he sent a copy of that Hymn to the Rising Sun. It's a tiny little book, a one-act play, over to every legislator. And it was the beginning of the end of the chain gang. And the other story I was going to tell you is later, when in 1940, Richard Wright had seen that play in Chicago. Richard Wright, who wrote Native Son, the very famous Richard Wright.
A very famous and pioneering African-American.
Yes,
author.
Indeed. And he had seen this play and realized that this white man down in the South could write about these black people. He had the voice. And so he came down. He thought, Paul Green is the person who should write the stage play for my Native Son. And so here they were in Chapel Hill in 1941, at the height of Jim Crow. And when word got out that this black man was going over to this white man's house, and not only that, there was mixed company, that there was going to be trouble. And Paul got wind of it, that there was going to be some problems coming up from Harnett County. So I hadn't told you about his ability to play baseball, but this is going to come in now, because Paul was so afraid for Richard Wright, and he followed him over to the colored part of town, to the rooming house where he was staying, and he hid in the bushes all night long with his baseball bat.
Oh, really?
Yes, to try to prevent any trouble from happening. And later, when they were up in Chicago, the two of them collaborating on the stage play, some kind of a racial fracas occurred, and Richard Wright apologized to Paul. He said, I'm so sorry about that. Everything was so calm in Chapel Hill. And Paul said, I never told him otherwise.
Well, you mentioned that now Paul Green has become, you know, a national figure. And I think you mentioned that he made some money writing in Hollywood.
Well,
when did that happen, and how did that affect his life?
Yeah, well, it affected a lot. He had gotten so busy with all the different things he was doing that he had to take a leave of absence from the university, because he had come to Chapel Hill to study with Horace Williams philosophy, and that's a story all in its own. And he was also teaching in the drama department. So he had four rambunctious children. He had a wife. He had all of his writing that he was doing, he had to take a leave of absence from his teaching. And so he was being encouraged to come out to Hollywood. And he went out and he was under contract with Fox. And he did a lot. He was writing for Clark Gable and Betty Davis and Lou Ayres and Janet Gaynor and lots of stars. And there's a wonderful little story about – and he was writing – I'll tell you about that in just a minute. But he – Betty Davis had said that her famous – her favorite line that had ever been written for her was by Paul Green, and it was in a little film called Cabin in the Cotton. And here's the line. "I'd let you kiss me, but I just washed my hair."
And so this is Paul Green's genius and feeling, both based on his Southern upbringing.
Yeah.
What a Southern woman would
say.
Say,
exactly. And he became discouraged. He wrote a lot of films, maybe 10 or 12
films. Could you make money writing for
Made Hollywood? Lots of money. Made lots of money. And that was, you know, but he decided that he didn't like the way the film industry was going. They were doing some cheap films. He wasn't too happy about when they had too much sex in the films. And he was a serious writer. He was a serious person. And he had serious things to say. And so he decided that he was not going to. And he walked away from that. And there's a well-known, another Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright named Catherine Ann Porter from Texas, who was writing plays at the same screenplays at the same time Paul was. And she described it this way. She said, "Paul was just like a precious soul in a bed of poison ivy." You know, I haven't said it quite right, but she was saying that. So he turned his back on that, and that was but he got the money, and he was able to buy up lots and lots of land, which was a very important time at that time because Chapel Hill was moving out and of town, and the soldiers were coming back from the war. And they needed a place to be, and the new faculty were coming into the university. And he bought several hundred acres around the whole Greenwood area, and I think it may have included Glen Lennox, that whole area. And then they divided it up, and so people have houses out there. And he and his wife lived out there for some years on Greenwood.
If you join us late, I'm visiting with Marcia Warren. She is the executive director of the Paul Green Foundation, and we're talking about Paul Green. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you did join us late, we're talking about Paul Green, and we're talking about Paul Green with the executive director of the Paul Green Foundation, Marcia Warren, and she's agreed just to give us a little bit of a briefing about your latest project. I know you've been working with Paul Green Foundation for a long time, but in the meantime, you've done so many other things that we'll talk about another day.
Yeah.
But tell us, what is it? You know, that's unusual for a prominent writer to mm-hmm. have a foundation.
Mm-hmm. It's just
around. Why the foundation?
It's just like him, isn't it, D.G.? It's just like Paul Green to be giving away. Well, what happened was he died in 1981 at the age of 87, having just parked his big tractor for the last time in the shed. And on the very day he died, he wrote three letters. He's that kind of a guy, just had a lot of things to do. When he died, his widow, Elizabeth Lay, and the four children, Paul, Bird, Betsy, and Jan, decided that rather than have the royalties from their father's work and their husband's work, they would form a foundation. They wanted to honor their husband.
So they gave up whatever
they did.
Funds they would have gotten from his estate and put it to work for the public or
right.
in honor of their father.
The part of the estate, D.G., that had to do with his writing, yes, all the royalties that would come from his work, which is a terribly generous thing to do. And so that was 1982, and it was formed that year, and it was to carry on Paul Green's work, and our mission is serving the arts and human rights. Because as I said earlier, the writing and the human rights are often blended into the writing piece. So we have been in operation since 1982. I came on the foundation in 1991, and our mission is to make grants. We're a tiny foundation. but we are able to make important little grants to struggling nonprofits. And so, for example, there was one that we did last year that was very interesting over in Greensboro. A company was doing a play that they were shadowing. It's called shadowing. And it was for people who were deaf. And so in the audience were the people who could see the actors in their regular colorful clothes doing, let's say it was the miracle worker. It may have been the miracle worker. And then behind them in black clothes were the actors doing the same thing, signing. And I just love that. That was bringing together the human rights and the arts together. We support Hidden Voices that does magnificent work in the prisons.
We had a play based
Count.
On experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
At the Playmakers production.
Right.
Based on the work bringing some sort of enrichment to life in prison. In the
yes,
prisons.
It was. It was on death row and it was called Count. And it was excellent.
So you are the foundation looks for these unusual kinds of things, mm-hmm. not for big grants, but for mm-hmm. enough to.
Mm-hmm.
And so what will the future that way? Will the royalties someday will run out?
Or? They will. They will. And we'll face that when the time comes. And, of course, eventually Paul wrote so early that some of his things are already in the public domain. So we do know that this will happen eventually. But some years ago, we decided that we needed to stay in business in perpetuity. So even though the foundation may fade away at some point or sunset, the granting will not. Because we gave our money to our invested money that to the Triangle Community Foundation. So we have an endowed fund at the Community Foundation and a non-endowed, a regular one. And we're able to make our grants from there so that the rest of our operating funds are just held at a local bank and we operate the office and all the expense of doing the business of the foundation. But the grants will always be there.
You mentioned, back to Paul Green we just got a little bit of time, but you mentioned that he had a little cabin next to his home in Chapel Hill in the Greenwood subdivision, I guess. But that cabin is no longer, where is that cabin?
Well, that cabin's, oh my goodness, Paul with his four children, they lived in the Glen. After they lived on Davy Circle, they lived in the Glen in 1925, and he had a little cabin behind his house, had to get out of the house to do his writing. When they moved to Greenwood, in 1939, he went up to northern Orange County and brought a cabin back log by log, he says, log by log by PEG, and had been an old cabin that where they'd made caskets and baskets. And he assembled that on the back of his lot. Well, after they left, because Paul had to keep getting out of town farther and farther so he could be on his tractor. He was a farmer at heart. And so they sold the place, and the cabin was left there. Well, some years later, the people who owned that house wanted to divide it. And so the cabin was up for grabs, as it were. And some local people, including Sally Vilas and Rhoda Wynn and others, got together, raised the funds. And down 15501, down Fordham Boulevard, came that cabin because the Botanical Garden, the North County Botanical Garden, had agreed to take it. So 1991, it went into the garden, and then it had to get its roof put back on, get its chimney rebuilt, and so forth. And they have made it into a beautiful little place. And I'm glad you mentioned that because we're in the process of trying to think how we can use that cabin more. And we have got a challenge from the Botanical Garden folks to see if we can fix that cabin up.
Well, marriage between Paul Green and the Botanical Garden is a fortuitous one, I guess, in some respects, because you mentioned Paul Green as a farmer, but Paul Green also had a love of plants, didn't he?
A love of plants. And his daughter, he wrote for 60 years, he walked around with his coat on with 3x5 cards in his coat pocket so that he could write down every single thing that he would hear, unusual sayings, treatments for something, old-timey things. All about plants. He loved plants, and he made sure that all of his children knew about plants. And so we turned those hundreds and hundreds of 3x5 cards into a book called Paul Green's Word Book. But some years back, let's say 5 years or so, his daughter Betsy collaborated with Ken Moore at the Botanical Garden.
Ken Moore, the heroic the former associate director at the Botanical Garden, who loves both plants and words.
Oh, my goodness, the botanist there. And, of course, Betsy, being a photographer, she needed a botanist. And so they went all over the state, and they took pictures. And so she developed her book called Paul Green's Plant Book. And so that – and, you know, another story that's fun, too, about the Botanical Garden is Totten. When they were making a Paul Green Theater down at Campbell University, which used to be Bowie's Creek Academy, the Paul Green Little Amphitheater, Totten, Dr. Totten was down there with him in boots and a plow and a mule making that. So that was a real hands-on thing. It's been
Marsha Warren, we could talk forever, I guess, about Paul Green and his great contributions and legacy. And I'm thinking especially in the enrichment of the community in which we live. I thank you for reminding us of that legacy, and hope that you'll come back and tell us more about Paul.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Our guest has been Marsha Warren. She's the director of the Paul Green Foundation. And we'll have a little bit of information about that on our website. And this is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.